It's 8:14, and we have our first guest on the line, Melina Stevens. She's the Snyderville Planning Chairperson, and she's here to tell us about last night's meeting. Good morning, Melina.
Good morning.
So let me ask, the most tangled discussion was about the road access for the wait. And the Planning Commission got into the weeds on this one, suffice it to say, and they were talking about legal definitions, planning issues, development history. So what do you want the staff to do about all of this information for next meeting?
So for the next meeting, we wanted some clarification. And as far as getting into the weeds, there was a lot of questions. It's a relatively complicated matter because of the way that the stipulations were placed upon the parcel because of other access. And so one of the things that we want additional clarification on is if there is a practical place that this parcel can be accessed that is not on Red Pine Road, if there is another way to do it, or if that is truly the only access point, because I think that would present some different issues and potentially change the course of that application.
So is there the potential for that? I mean, what other access would there be if it's not Red Pine Road?
As far as the way that the CDMA is and in the different agreements within the canyon, that additional parcels, neighboring parcels, are obligated, from what our legal counsel indicated, to allow access through their parcels. So initially, the way that the wait parcel was intended was to have access through the Escala parcel. We just want to know if that is practical, if access means road access, or if that means that when they built the Escala, we believe that they may have included additional spaces to accommodate the casitas that were supposed to have been built on this parcel back in 2006. So we also wanted to know, as far as with the parking spaces in the Escala, if the density that was indicative of how many spaces, if that was actually built, or if the Escala was just accounting for the current square footage of that actual building and parcel.
Okay. Would you just remind our listeners what the wait parcel is? What is the development that's being proposed here?
So the wait parcel is on 2306 Red Pine Road. It's essentially right across from the Aspen Creek Crossing neighborhood, just, I guess, south of the Escala.
Okay. And how large of a project is it? What does it entail?
It's a relatively small parcel. It's about, I believe, just around an acre. There are some stipulations. I believe there's about, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but somewhere in the realm of 60,000 to 70,000 square feet of a mix of commercial and housing that is allowed, or not housing, but hotel lodging that is allowed on that parcel. However, there's stipulations such as setbacks. There's a 50-foot buffer. Because of where it's at in the canyons on the outskirts, there would have to be feathering. So there's a 50-foot buffer, and then after that, within the next 35 feet, there can only be two stories, and then after that, they can step it up. So the parcel is limited as far as how many square feet they practically can put on there. That was one thing that the commission, though, wanted to look into as well, is what could this become based on the stipulation, so that the community and the neighbors that had concerns about traffic, that had concerns about primarily traffic and access on this relatively small road, so that they could have an understanding of what to expect.
Okay, so what you're looking for then at the next meeting, will you be making a decision if they are able to come in and give you some reasonable proposals on access and that kind of thing?
I mean, we could be making a decision. This past meeting, it was noticed as a public hearing and possible action. We determined to continue it to a later meeting because we felt we needed additional information in order to make an informed and fair decision, based on we just didn't have all of the information and facts in front of us that we really needed. So if we were given all of that information, I think that it is very plausible we could make a decision at that time.
Okay, and what kind of public input did you get last night on this, if any?
So during the public hearing, we had one of the neighbors, I believe from Aspen Creek Crossing, that came and spoke on behalf of himself in the neighborhood. We had quite a lot of public input as far as email communications that we read prior to the meeting, and so we did have access to that, and we did read all of that, and so those people were heard as well.
Okay, great. Anything else about this project that you want people to understand or know about?
As far as this project, I would just hope that the public as well as the developers understand that we really are looking at all of the information and trying to make the best fair decision based on the facts, based on the laws that we're really... I mean, as you indicated, it was a long discussion. It was something that we really labored over and will continue because we want to make the best decision because these decisions last and we understand they have impacts.
Okay. On a couple of other items, the Planning Commission came to approvals pretty quickly. First, they approved the Pendry Hotel, and this is a pretty big hotel in the resort core, three buildings and over 267,000 square feet of hotel, commercial, retail, skier support. How did you get to this decision on, you know, a relative quick response? How did you all come to that?
So we had done a site visit to the Pendry a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago. During that, we were able to look at the site. We looked at some tentative plans. They weren't quite as detailed as the formal application we saw yesterday. Part of the reason, I think, for the relatively quick turnaround with that, as far as the discussion yesterday, is that this parcel was intended for a high-density project, such as the Pendry, and so what they gave to us is what was expected, and we spent, you know, a year and a half on the Canyon's master plan amendment, and so with that, this was one of the key pieces of that amendment, and when the Pendry came in, they came in with a project that was anticipated based on the work we'd done with the Canyon's master plan. There were a few issues, but they'd been working hard with staff as far as engineering and some of these other in the planning department to overcome those. And all of the issues were minimal to the point that we could approve it with the conditions that they resolved those with the appropriate staff and got all of the got signed off by everyone needed.
Okay, and then you also gave an approval for a lot owner in the Long Rifle subdivision in Silver Creek who wanted a plat amendment. It allowed this person to increase a barn from 2,000 square feet to a limit of 10,000?
This is a relatively minimal request. He wanted to increase. The parcel had been had some changes to it previously, and he wanted to increase the pad essentially so that he could build a larger structure, which he went through the appropriate process to build a bigger structure in that area. The size he wanted was allowed, so he needed to increase the pad so that he could do that.
So he
allowed under certain provisions.
So he's taken that pad to 10,000 square feet. Is that, or is that just the limit of what's allowed?
So he wanted to be able to build a structure that was 10,000 square feet. Yes. And this was to just increase the pad. This wasn't an approval of the actual structure.
Okay. And then he also asked for a height limit increase to 28 feet from 26 feet?
I don't recall that piece. I apologize.
Okay.
It was a relatively late meeting at that point.
Okay, long evening. So a lot of times there are lots of controversies in Silver Creek over these kinds of requests for accessory buildings. And how did you all get to that decision so quickly? People seem to come out in droves on those kinds of things.
Well, with this, I mean, a 10,000 square foot accessory building is a common size of an accessory building in that neighborhood. And with this just increasing the pad, there wasn't, we, there wasn't, it wasn't, it wasn't controversial. We had a public hearing on it, and there wasn't any input from the neighbors as far as issues with that. And really, if the neighbors don't come and express the reasons why, factually, why this shouldn't occur, then we don't have that to go off of. And we can't restrict somebody's rights just based off of the neighbors might not like this or this, you know, especially if it's consistent with what's already going on in the neighborhood.
Sure. Okay. Anything else, Melita, that you want to talk about?
I guess just as always, we really appreciate staff and all the hard work that they put into all of these items yesterday. With the pendry and the weight parcel, there's lots of moving pieces of that, and we really appreciate all of the work that staff's putting into this.
Okay. Well, thank you, Melina Stevens. That's the Snyderville Planning Chairperson. And I appreciate you giving us a call.
Thanks. Have a great one.
Bye. Well, good morning. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. We're coming on 8:30 in the studio. I have Alfred Knotts, Park City Interim Transportation Director, as well as the project manager, Brian Allen. He's with UDOT, and the two of them are here to talk about the results of the study, which is sitting here in front of me, and it's a stack. It's 1,400 pages worth of study, which is amazing. Anyway, Interim Transportation Director Alfred Knotts, thanks for coming by, both of you. Is that a new title?
It is. It is right now, and we're going through the budgeting process, and this is part of a consolidation of transportation disciplines within the city. So we're looking to make sure that we can pull all of our multimodal transportation planners and project managers under one umbrella, which really creates a comprehensive transportation department, as opposed to having transit and public works, having transportation planning in City Hall, having some trails responsibilities and sustainability and parking under public works. It brings it under one umbrella, which is pretty much a typical structure within a municipality.
Okay, so it's really pretty much a reorganization.
It is in some extent. It's really taken mostly it's existing resources and existing positions, and then creating more of a traditional transportation organizational structure that fits what Park City's general plan calls for, with focus on multimodal and alternative transportation, but also making sure that we're incorporating other transportation demand management strategies, such as paid parking and parking management, and then looking at events and things like that and making sure that we're all very, very integrated.
Okay, and so is there an org chart somewhere if someone was interested? Is it online yet? Or
it was actually in the last budget agenda items within the council packet, so they can be found within there. And again, it's a lot of existing positions. We are creating new positions within the transit structure. They're not creating more FTEs, full-time equivalent employees. But what it's doing is taking some of those existing positions and making them more specialized, focusing on federal requirements as it relates to drug and alcohol testing, as it relates to training, as it relates to Americans with Disability Act, eligibility screening. So things that need to be specialized that are right now sometimes done by committee when it comes to being shared responsibilities, that we have one point of contact with these very rigid and specific responsibilities within the transit system.
Okay. And are there new positions being hired? Are there new people being hired? Or are there people who will be losing their jobs?
No, there is nobody losing their job. We did create out of the last structure, there was a transit quality manager and this transit systems manager that now has been reclassified as having a specific transit manager. And then with under there was an assistant transit manager. So those two positions now are kind of restructured to have more of a hierarchical rather than being peers within the system. So that, again, that's more of a traditional transit structure, having the primary point of contact for transit being the transit manager, and then the day-to-day more operational issues assigned to the assistant transit manager. So those are still vacant right now, and we are recruiting for those and interviewing as we speak.
Okay. Let's move on to the environmental assessment study. I have Brian Allen with UDOT. He's the project manager for this study. He's here with us. Thanks for coming by, Brian.
It's my pleasure.
So it looks like a draft version has just been completed. It's 1,400 pages long. Before we get into it, is that a normal environmental study length? I mean, is that what happens when you do an environmental study?
Yeah, it's a typical length for an environmental assessment. We did analyze a lot of different alternatives. I believe there was 9 alternatives analyzed in this environmental assessment.
Okay, and then we do have soil issues, contamination issues in that area. We have wetlands. We have state park, the corridor there. So tell us a little bit about this. It's open for public input at this point. And yes. what are the highlights that have come out of this? Because most people will not be reading that, I don't think.
We realize that. And we prepared a video that's really informative that you can find on the UDOT website. The website for the project, I personally just like to Google UDOT SR248 improved. Or you can go to SR248 improved. And you can access the video, the document. We prepared what's called a story map, which is a summary of the process that we went through to arrive at our build alternative or the preferred alternative. And there's a lot of information online that you can access because we realize that not everyone has the time to read
Right. Well, it'll be on my list right after the Mueller report is finished. But so okay, what can you give us some highlights of what was discovered in the environmental assessment done there?
And there is an executive summary. I'd like to point that out too. So that does give a pretty good synopsis. And then the chapter 2 and chapter 3 is where the emphasis is of the what Brian spoke to of the alternatives that have been evaluated. Somewhat ad nauseum. So some of the highlights, I think, is that, there's been ideas and concepts that have been thrown around within the community and even other studies that have looked about, well, why don't you just put a roundabout here? Why don't you just reverse the lanes here? Why don't you, do two-way in, two-way out, things like that? Well, that has actually never gone to the level of a technical analysis, and that's why you see a document of this size, which is pretty typical. This is an environmental assessment. God forbid we ever have to do an environmental impact statement. It'd probably be twice this size. Yeah, exactly. But it does answer a lot of the questions in the community that have been batted around just at a conceptual level or a philosophical level. And I think what this does and what it's intended to do is to really take all of those alternatives, potential alternatives, and see how they actually perform, how they perform today versus the 2040, which is the building horizon that we have to plan for, the state, the federal government, ourselves. If we arrive at the preferred alternative approved, then we're looking at an investment of close to $60 million within the corridor. So if we go out and spend $60 million or anything within that range, and within 5 years, the corridor breaks down or does not operate as intended, then we've really accomplished nothing. So these projects take, just to get to construction, a good 5 to 7 to 10 years. Even after we're approved this document, if it does get approved based on the public comment, then we're still looking at a lot of years out, subsequent steps with right-of-way acquisition, utility relocation.
Project funding.
Yes. Funding is not, the project's not fully funded because we don't necessarily know what we're building yet. And there's still final design. So there's just preliminary design within the document. The preliminary design gives you enough information to say this is what those impacts are to the things that you mentioned, Carolyn, is that, what does this alternative do to the wetlands? What does this alternative do to recreational resources? What does it do to archaeological resources if they are in the area? What does it do to noise and things like that? So it gives all the information on natural resource impacts as well as human resource impacts as well. So it allows the decision makers to make an informed decision about, what project do we want to move forward with.
Okay, so the reality is that we're a box canyon, mm-hmm. basically. So you can make it as efficient as possible by doing all kinds of things, high occupancy vehicle, alternating lanes, that type of thing. But once you hit, the intersection with Bonanza, even, or Kearns Boulevard, it's not changing. I mean, so realistically, what does an environmental study tell us that we didn't really know about in terms of the impacts? I mean, we can't go any farther once you hit that point.
Exactly. And that's
really. Can't take any more people.
No, and that's really where some of our other strategies come into play when it comes to parking management. That's a component, again, that looks at the supply and the demand. Well, if there's not ample parking, there's not a place to receive vehicles, and you're over capacity in these other areas, then those are a constraining factor also. So, again, that's how this all kind of plays together about it. You can engineer your way out of a certain solution, but when there's supply and demand issues when it comes to parking and this downstream capacity also, there are constraints. And what we're really looking at, you know, when you look at that corridor, we're looking at a true choke point issue. You know, we have four lanes on the east end, and we have essentially four lanes on the west end once you get past Sidewinder. So we're really creating a consistent cross-section within that corridor. And then how we manage those lanes or what other opportunities exist within there, that's the next step of the discussion also. So the capacity exists on both ends. It's really we're dealing with a very, very confined choke point in the Wyatt Earp area, the turning conflicts within the school campus. And then once you get down to Bonanza and those areas, then the capacity is back to, you know, the cross section that feeds into the intersect or to the corridor also.
Yeah, and Brian, how often have you worked on projects like that?
So I've my background is I'm actually a professional engineer, so I've had the opportunity to be a roadway designer. So I've designed multiple projects, and I've worked my way up to be a project manager now. So
you've dealt with studies like this where you have those choke points that Alfred mentioned.
Yes.
And so is there some magic thing that is in this study that says, here's the answer?
There is no silver bullet, as we've all talked about. It comes into all these other strategies, such as multimodal transportation, alternative transportation. And, you know, we talk about that's not a year-round viable alternative, but this alternative does provide bike lanes through the corridor that now do not currently exist also. And then also looking to make sure that we can facilitate transit use within the corridor. And I want to point that out within the document that there is, with the preferred alternative, there is flexibility. This alternative provides flexibility in the corridor to provide that priority to transit also. But we still have to, and the state has to, plan for general purpose traffic. You know, we do have to plan for the automobile because that is the technology that does exist in the primary, but we want to make sure that when we build a project that we do have that flexibility in the near future and in the far off future that corridor can be repurposed. And those are great discussions that we've had with UDOT. They're a great partner. They do not, you know, view this as a Bangor Highway, or they don't view this as the I-15 corridor. They do recognize that this is a box canyon. This isn't their traditional facility that's moving freight or oil and gas through, like a town of Vernal where they're looking through pure throughput. They're looking to make sure that the highway itself and their facility fits the context of Park City.
Sure. Okay. And we're talking about the Narrows area where you have wetlands on one side, on the south side, and on the north side you've got a mountain, basically. Does the environmental impact study address that kind of a geographic condition? I mean, are we cutting into that mountain ultimately?
It does require us to have some excavation on the hillside of the mountain, and that is really required by the Army Corps of Engineers under the Clean Water Act and the Army Corps of Engineers 401 and 404 permitting. You're required. There's three steps of wetland disturbance, and the first step is avoidance. And if you can avoid wetlands, then that is the requirement. So the avoidance is what we're limited to. So
okay, well, it'll be really interesting to see how it all rolls out over the coming years. So what are the next steps with this? Public input.
Yeah, and I can, you know, this is, UDOT is the signatory to the document. We are doing this jointly. They are one of only a handful of U.S. or state DOTs that do have NEPA delegation, which is the National Environmental Policy Act. That's typically handled by the Federal Highway Administration. UDOT and states like California, where I came from, Caltrans has delegation authority, Texas, New York, and there's just a handful. So I think it's really important to note that, that gives them the partnership that we do have. It gives us the direct connection. So I'll let kind of Brian speak to the next couple of steps of that, given that they are the NEPA signatory. But we do have a 30-day comment period that started yesterday.
Okay, great.
Yeah, so we'd encourage people to get on, as I mentioned, the website and watch the video and go through the document and view the highlights. We also have a public hearing, an open house this June 26th. From 4 to 6 at Treasure Mountain High School. And once again, I just encourage people to really get into the document, really start reading. We'd love to hear your comments. We want to hear your feedback. We really want to make a solution that works for everyone.
Okay, and the executive summary is on the website also?
Yes.
Okay, is that on Park City's website as well as this SR 248 improved link?
We are posting that today. We'll make a direct link. We'll put that most likely in the spotlight. As Brian mentioned, the video on there, is very, very informative. It explains the purpose and need of the project, which is an actual technical and legal term within NEPA, and how the alternatives do or do not meet the purpose and need. So okay. We also have that in Spanish, so I wanted to make sure that we made note of that also. We're making that more prevalent today. I did look at the site last night and make sure that all that information was easily accessible. That was one thing that was not as intuitive as I think it should be, so we're making that more prevalent today. And we will also be doing a presentation to City Council on the 20th also. But again, it's important to note what Brian just referenced is that at Treasure Mountain Junior High School is that is the official public hearing for this part of the process. So we're required to receive all documents or all comments and then incorporate as necessary and or respond to those comments. So again, this is a draft document. So mm-hmm. until the document, until it goes through the 30-day comment period, it is drafted up until that point. And not until the comments are received and incorporated does the document become final. And that timeline is really looking still to the fall for that finalization.
Okay, and the tunnel is under construction, supposed to be finished before school starts, right by the high school. And any updates on that you want to give listeners?
Yes, we are a little behind schedule. I will be honest about that. We've had some, it's a very constrained project site. We did start the project during school, to the dismay of some people, but that was actually in coordination with the school district to make sure that we could finish the project as close to the start of school as opposed to the end. So there was a kind of a pick your poison type of a decision to make. So we decided to start the project a little earlier. And they will start moving into the right-of-way here in the next couple of weeks. So that's something for people to be aware of. Just be very, very careful out there, cautious. We plan, there's no intention to have any one-way traffic control. There's the intent is in the contract requirements for the contractor to keep both lanes of traffic open at all times. That is a separate project. It's part of the broader corridor project, but we didn't put that into this project or this process or this 1,400-page document because it did not have federal dollars, so we did not want to federalize the project so that it could move forward independently. So we're looking to hopefully complete that before school starts.
Okay, and then just an update, an unfortunate accident happened over the weekend with a bus going into a ditch, and the driver was arrested for DUI, but he contends that he fell asleep at the wheel. And we just have done a report on unemployment levels being at just record low levels. I have to get my orientation right. Anyway, there. Is there someone at the transit center that checks drivers before they head out, and identifies whether or not they're fit to, take on control of that vehicle?
We do. We have a check-in process at around 5:15 in the morning. Drug screening or alcohol screening is not, explicitly part of that process. Observation, though, and there is a term within the Federal Transit Administration, if there's reasonable suspicion, then we will test people on the spot. I think we're going to reevaluate about going above and beyond that. There is federal requirements about random drug testing. They just increased that in January 1st from 25% to 50%, and that's due to the legalization of marijuana in a lot of states. And then the alcohol random screening and testing is 10% You know, we're talking internally right now. If we're doing this drug testing at the same time, why not do the alcohol testing? So that's something that we're evaluating. Another thing is, as you mentioned, yeah, it's hard to find drivers, but I would much rather come to council and say that we can't run certain routes because we don't have drivers, rather than put just a warm body in that seat. And the driver had been with us for some time. It was a very, very poor decision from what we can tell, based on the information that we have right now, but it is going through a process, and we do have checks and balances built into the system for post-accident alcohol and drug screening that is required by the Federal Transit Administration, and that is how the information came to light to us also. So first responders on the scene, I was there within 5 minutes on Saturday. There was 3 to 4 sheriff's units on site, 1 to 2 fire units on site, and nobody suspected anything, and it's not anybody's fault except the person responsible, and we'll make sure that it does not happen again.
Okay, great. Thank you for coming by, gentlemen. Appreciate the updates, and good luck with the public input. Hopefully we'll be able to help get the word out about that
event. Thank you. We appreciate that.
Thanks. And my final guest today is Alyssa Mitchell. She is the Summit County Health Educator. She is here to talk about some concerns and issues that we now face, that the weather is warming, specifically talking about heat stroke and people being left in cars, children especially, and pets, I would guess. So welcome. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
So on average, every 10 days, a child dies from heat stroke in a vehicle, and in more than half of these cases, the caregiver forgot the child was in the car?
Yes, and something that statistic doesn't really talk about is a lot of the time that these caregivers are out of their normal routine. So, for example, my husband actually usually drops off and picks up the kids every morning, and then I do it once in a while as my husband's work schedule needs me to, if he has to go in early. And so a lot of the time, the same thing happens to all other parents. So usually mom or dad will drop off a child, but when the other parent goes to drop off a child at daycare, that's when we start noticing that children get left in hot cars. Parents get in their zone. I don't have a better way of saying it other than that. They drive, they're in their normal routine, and unfortunately, kids will just get left in the cars. We also see it quite a bit with grandparents who don't normally transport their kids, also tend to forget that they're in the back seat. And sometimes it's just a combination of having a busy morning and being out of your routine. And then sometimes the kids will fall asleep in the back of the car. So if it's especially quiet, sometimes parents will almost forget that their kids are back there, and it's just an unfortunate accident. But that's why I'm here today, to help remind people, as the weather warms up, it is so important to make sure that you check your back seat and make sure that there are no kids or pets left in the vehicle, because the car will heat up very quickly during the summer months.
Yeah, so how fast does it heat up in the summer?
It's actually within 10 minutes. Your car can climb almost 20 degrees in about 10 minutes of sitting outside in your car. So if it's 80 degrees outside and you're inside for 10 minutes, your car could heat up to about 100 degrees within 10 minutes. And especially for pets and children, it is really hard for them to regulate their body temperature. And so they are more affected by the heat than an adult or person would be. So they are more likely to be affected more quickly by that increase in heat. Right.
And so just cracking a window isn't going to do the trick if it's going, you know, that quickly.
No, in fact, there's hardly any airflow or change when the window is cracked. What studies show is there's hardly any change in degree or temperature, even with the window cracked or even being in the shade as well. So it's really just important, if you're going somewhere and you have your kids with you, to make sure that you know that you're just going to have to take them out of the car, even if they fall asleep, and take them with you. And I mean, as a parent, I get it. You don't want to wake up your child, but at the same time, it's so important that they not be left alone. And not only for the risk of heat stroke, but we've seen even in the Salt Lake Valley area, people break into cars, especially at gas stations when parents go in just to pay for the gas. People have hopped in the car and taken off, and the kids are in the back seat. It's so dangerous.
It reminds me of when mine were really small and you just couldn't even turn your head while they were in the bath. You you couldn't even step away from the side of that tub.
No, kids, similar. Stuff happens in just the blink of an eye, and you have to just keep an eye on them at all times. One other thing we tell parents about, some of these kids that have unfortunately passed away from being left in vehicles were actually playing in the vehicles. So parents will leave their cars unlocked in the driveway because they think they're home. Maybe they're unpacking things from the vehicle and they forget to lock their door. Well, kids like to get in the car. They like to play and pretend they're mom and dad, and unfortunately become stuck inside the vehicle and can't figure out how to get out. So one thing we also want to remind parents is when your vehicle is parked, lock your doors. Make sure nobody's inside and lock your doors so kids can't get stuck.
And Alyssa, you have some other ideas about reminders.
Yes, and so especially if you're out of your routine, one nice thing to get in the habit of is to stick something behind your seat to help remind you as you get out of the car that you need to go grab something. So for me, like I have my purse with me all the time. So I would, and actually I still find me doing this, and it's just out of habit, I'll stick my purse right underneath one of my kids' car seats. And as I get out, I'll go to grab my purse. And that's with or without my kids, but it always just provides that extra reminder of, okay, I need to grab this. Car seats are clear. I can move on. I've heard of people doing it with their shoes. There's apps on your phone that you can download to help set reminders of check your back seat. And you can find those just on Android or Apple stores. And unfortunately, I'm drawing a blank on the name of the app specifically at the moment, but I could provide that for you later.
Yeah, just search it.
But there's apps available. And honestly, it's even a good idea to set up a system with your daycare center. So, for example, if my kids are not at their daycare and preschool center by 7:30, I actually get a text or a phone call from the center saying, where's Zoe and Myla? And I mean, most of the time it's usually just traffic that's preventing me from getting there. But if you ask if your daycare or caregiver during the day, if they have that system in place where they call to check up and figure out where the kids are, we find that there's less issues with kids being forgotten.
Yeah, sure. And taking action is really critical. If you see something like this happening.
Oh, yes. If you see something, say something. So if you see a pet left alone in a vehicle, or if you see a child left alone in a vehicle, call 911. Say, I am at this location. There is a child left alone in the vehicle. Somebody needs to come check on them. And do it as fast as possible. That way, the child is not left in the car any longer than necessary.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else that you want to let people be reminded of for the summer months?
Well, just for the summer months, as you and your kids are out vacationing and traveling, please make sure to have lots of water with you to stay hydrated. And also remember that sunscreen, SPF 30 or higher.
That's great. Thanks, Alyssa. Anything else?
For any further questions about heat stroke safety, just visit our website at SummitCountyHealth.org, or they're welcome to call the health department, and I'd be happy to answer any questions as well.
Thank you very much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
That's Alyssa Mitchell. She is the health educator from the Summit County Health Department.